Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, we are joined by David Kittle. David's been in the mortgage banking business since 1978. In 1994, he founded Associates Mortgage Group and owned that business till 2006. He's the past chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association and currently is the senior director, industry relations for iMark, a company that pursues loan fraud for the mortgage insurance industry and for Fannie and Freddie. David, welcome back.
Good. Thanks for being here.
There's first thing I want to do is talk a little bit about the in-house checks and balances, since you're very familiar with the business. If I'm a mortgage broker, am I required to have some checks and balances to make sure that the loans that we're about to fund and pass on are in fact legit? And is that in-house?
Well, it should be in your quality control plan, but if you're a broker, which means you're table funding the loan and you're selling the loan to another lender who's then going to turn around and sell it to Fannie or Freddie, it will ultimately be the interim lender who they're selling it to on the wholesale basis before it goes to a GSE. If it's going to Fannie Mae right now, they have something in their contracts and their agreements that the ultimate lender, the underwriter of the loan and the funder of the loan, should do certain checks for fraud before they fund. So it is in place, but it's not necessarily the requirement of the mortgage broker.
Okay. Is it true that a lot of audits are done randomly after the funding?
You talk about the fraud audits?
Well, in other words, just they're going to check the file, and are there audits that are performed randomly on a certain percentage of loans, even if they're not even they're not behind or anything? They just got funded. Do they do any of that after the fact and then find that something's wrong very quickly?
Yes, they do. In fact, most quality control plans, especially the ones if you're a non-supervised lender through FHA or HUD, require a minimum of 10%. And that's pretty standard throughout the industry. I know some lenders have gone even higher than that. You know, we would recommend at this point, with fraud being as prevalent as it is, that you should go up to as much as 25% and do it randomly. Really where we need to go is what I mentioned earlier, and we need to get to a place where we're doing everything we can to detect this before the loan funds. Simple phone call to the borrower before they close. Is this you? Are you buying these houses? Are you putting this money down? Determine whether or not identity theft has occurred and somebody's buying a house in your name, or you know, they're just selling your property and you don't even know it, which has happened before. And then you have a title company or a closing attorney that may be in the scheme with them, and then all of a sudden your house has been sold. So there's ways we can do it. We just haven't moved far enough to where we can do it before closing.
The cases that you've just mentioned, I guess those would, I would just have thought that those were almost non-existent percentages, but that is fairly, that's a piece of what you have to deal with, is somebody's identity's been stolen, and either that or their property, and that's a fairly healthy number. That's scary.
I don't know how healthy it is. I can say that it happens for sure.
Okay.
I think probably the type of fraud that has been committed most over the last 3 or 4 years is strictly on the no income, no asset loans, where people lied about their income, their job, and hope to flip the property, and then appraised values have gone down and unemployment's gone up. And that's just made fraud more prevalent. Right now, the fraud schemes that are out there are set up, they're done, as we talked earlier, over the internet. Documents are produced as good or better than originals, and people are defrauding lenders all the way through the loan and walking into straw borrowers and lying about everything.
And we had covered the idea that it may have been as prevalent in the boom market, but it didn't show up as much. But there's a lot of talk about mortgage fraud right now, and you would think that people would be getting the message that that's something that they would not do if they, you know, if they had any hope of having freedom for the rest of their life. Do you feel that there is a deterrent? The more it's talked about, the people decide, okay, I'm not going to go there?
Well, until it, you know, with as many cases as Department of Justice and the FBI have, the onesie-twosies out there, the small fraud, aren't getting the attention that they should have. They're going after the bigger fish, or the ones that are doing 20 properties in a group or 50 or more, as compared to somebody who's done it on just one particular house.
Okay.
So the more they commit, the bigger the fish, and the more they will go after them to prosecute and make sure that, you know, they're sent to jail.
There's definitely going to be a new category of loan fraud. Not that you need to be any busier, but B of A has recently said that they're going to pursue short sales above and beyond the pursuit of the property going to trustee sale. There was a report that just came out today that they think that they save about 15% when a short sale is accomplished as opposed to the trustee sale. But there are transactions, and it's become known as flopping, where an investor will make an offer on a property at a reduced number. The broker will submit that offer to the lender. The lender is looking at a broker price opinion that they feel is accurate, and that'll set up the purchase price. And then, lo and behold, it's resold shortly thereafter or virtually at the same time for a different price. And that is a new topic of fraud. And I hadn't even heard the term myself until about 2 or 3 days ago. But the short
sale. Well, this is a new term to me also.
Okay.
And it's something that does not surprise me with the amount of delinquency, high unemployment, and loan modifications that are going on out there. Lenders have a tremendous backlog of property that they want to get off their books. This is a new scheme, first time I'm hearing of it, but it doesn't surprise me at all. And it's something that, as it becomes more prevalent, again, I reiterate, if we could do an upfront audit, a simple phone call before the loan funds, you could stop something like this.
Well, you know, I think some of it is actually, if the lender, and here's where the absence of fraud would be, and that's a good thing to discuss. Fraud is where somebody's sort of having the wool pull over their eyes and making a decision not fully informed. But there's a case for you have a property, it's maybe not in the best of condition, and I'm gonna close a transaction for all cash with the intent of reselling it, and the lender does, okay, I'll agree to a short sale at a reduced number, and then the property is resold later for a profit. I think you then don't have fraud. You have a transaction that was profitable for investor, but you're missing the element of the surprise or the deceit. Would you agree with that's probably an okay transaction?
At first blush, the way you're describing it, probably so. If there was no information given that is wrong with the intent to defraud anybody, then it would appear to be okay. But any time you give information on a loan application that's incorrect, it's maybe not classified as fraud, but it's misrepresentation. It's wrong.
I had an interesting thing happen, and I wonder if this is some of the problems that you deal with and if it's as prevalent as I'm thinking it might be. I filled out a loan app, and I hadn't borrowed money in quite some time. And this was in 2005 or 6. And it was part of a 1031 exchange, and I was going to do a loan. And it kind of took a while for it to fund, and I finally got the loan docs, and I read all the paperwork, and my loan application had been radically changed. And so I called up the loan broker, and I said, this isn't my loan app. And she says, yes, yours was so confusing and too many properties and corporations. She said, we just simplified it so we could get the loan done. Well, of course, but I just said, well, I think that's loan fraud. And she was very offended, and she said, well, we do that for all our clients. And I just thought, my goodness. And there wasn't even a discussion about the changes. And, you know, there's times I do sign paperwork that I don't pay strict attention to it. So had I signed that, I mean, I would have been a part of it, but never even knew it occurred. So I guess my question is, do you find cases where the broker sort of acted independently and the borrower really didn't even have a clue why they got the loan or why they were
Absolutely.
Able to.
Wow. It happens all the time. And, you know, you should report them. You should take the next step and make sure that's reported. That's called data integrity. They can change the data. I mean, it's even happened where sellers of large pools of loans changed the data before they sold it to the GSEs. If you can imagine that,
wow,
to make the loan saleable, hoping that nobody found it. All the time, the borrower will come back, you know, they don't read their documents. Now, let's go back to comments about Congress that we talked about in the first segment. The loan application is so overwhelming to most people. It is so onerous in documentation. Nobody reads all the documents. They can't. They can't understand them. Most loan originators in our business today can't sit down, and again, broad brush painting here, they can't sit down and explain truth in lending, which is the most important document you have. So when these documents get switched after application and go to closing, they walk away and people do and they think they've got it done. And it's been changed by the loan officer or the mortgage loan company and to get the loan closed and sold.
When in the future, I mean, we developed this shadow banking system, which became a very big part of how we move money and in and out of the mortgages and so forth. How important is trust to that system returning to be a functional asset again for the mortgage business?
Well, like I have told Congress over the last couple of years, since 2008, we're probably making the best loans we've made in 15 years. Nobody wants the risk that they're taking. None of the lenders want to repurchase loans. Nobody wants to make a bad loan. But it is up to the mortgage broker, lender, bank, whoever it is, to make sure that the people they hire, they're responsible for that loan officer. So they need to do a better job of checking what their people are doing. If you have a loan officer that is producing on your chart somewhere, it's not your top producer, and all of a sudden they go from a mediocre loan officer to top producer in a few months, that ought to raise a red flag for you. You ought to be able to look and say, how did that happen? What made you change your production habits all of a sudden? There are red flags out there. People just have to be aware of what they are.
Okay. One of the hot buttons right now are loan modifications. And what's interesting about loan modification, it's almost the opposite of a stated income loan. To get a loan mod, you have to have hardship. Do you see people attempting to get loan mods by trying to look poorer than they are?
Absolutely. It does happen. And let me turn this around and give you another observation on it. What we need to do as a country, as an industry, is to be honest with these people. They couldn't afford the house the first time. Modifying them and keeping them in a house, most people don't want to stay in their house anyway, especially if they've lied and committed fraud on the first loan. But here we are, putting these people back in the house with a new loan, with a reduced balance or a reduced interest rate, and they're going to go ahead and re-default 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 months later. So all we're doing is putting off the inevitable. It's almost like an alcoholic. The best way for them to recover is for them to get to their lowest point. And we need to get the lowest point on values, and at that point, the market will start to come back.
When a company hears that your company's going to pay them a visit and do an audit, that must be a pretty tough day for them. And I guess I'm curious: are there signs that you can tell that okay, these people are definitely hiding information or trying to cleanse a file after the fact? So you guys must be pretty good at detecting cooperation or somebody that's really trying to hide stuff.
Well, actually, it doesn't quite happen like that.
Okay.
What happens is the loan will go into default, and it'll get kicked back, let's say, from the GSEs to one of the big lenders, and the lenders then will file a claim with the mortgage insurance company. The mortgage insurance company, before it pays that claim, will send that file to us. Then we will go back and talk to the borrower, the realtor, or whomever we can on the file to reprocess that loan and get all the real facts about what happened. Many times we'll call a borrower and they say, I didn't, just like you gave a minute ago. that wasn't the information I put on the loan application. Or, no, the loan officer encouraged me to raise my income so I could get the loan, with promising when the house was flipped I'd make part of the profit. That's the type of investigation we do. We don't walk into a lender's office and sit down with them. So it's not like being visited by 60 Minutes.
Okay. One loan at a time. That's a lot of manpower and a lot of work.
Well, we've got our own proprietary system that has no legacy issues, developed by Bob Simpson and his team, great IT staff. And we have over 100 employees in Santa Ana, California. We hire very, very smart young college students who don't have bad habits in our industry, and we train them to do the right thing and look at loans the right way. And we can go through a file very quickly and determine whether or not fraud has been committed on that. We're efficient, we're cost-effective, and we deliver the file to our clients on time and as promised.
When you detect something wrong with the file, you're reporting that back. Now, at what point does that get passed on to the next level? Are the lenders, and again, you're much more familiar with the mortgage business than I am. Are the lenders, if there's fraud involved, first thing is they're always asked to repurchase the loan?
Well, no, they may be asked to repurchase the loan for a number of reasons.
Okay.
But then the lender will turn around and then make a claim on the mortgage insurance piece. And before the mortgage insurance company wants to pay that claim, they want to make sure that the person or the lender that made that loan did everything that they were supposed to do on that loan. Was there misrep or fraud on it? So we determine if there was or wasn't. We get all the facts, turn it back to the mortgage insurance company, and then they make a determination whether or not they want to pay the claim or kick the loan back to the lender.
Okay. So not all denied mortgage claims become criminal files.
That's correct.
Okay.
Not all of them do.
Right. They just become, the loss is not going to be incurred by the mortgage insurance. It's all... Now, is it, at that point, is it Fannie or Freddie's loss, or is it the originator's loss?
Well, if Fannie or Freddie, if they've kicked it back on their repurchase agreement to a big bank or a lender, it becomes their loss if, in fact, the mortgage insurance company will not pay the claim. If the lender has bought that loan on a wholesale or a correspondent relationship, they have buyback agreements with those brokers or mortgage lenders, private mortgage lenders, and they then will go after them. And hopefully, they have the cash to repurchase that loan. They have the skin in the game. That's what Congress has been all about over the last year and a half, to make sure that if you are in the business of lending, that you have enough cash equity in your company, that it's not just on paper, it's real cash, in order to stand up and repurchase these loans if they go bad.
How does California rank as far as the fraud that's done? Are we number one?
I don't know if you're number one or not, but you've got to be close, top three. I think the statistic I heard that over 80% of all the loans that were in foreclosure in California had fraud committed on them. That's way too high, but it gives a snapshot of what happened in places like Henderson, Nevada, Southern California, down in Dade and Broward County in Florida. I mean, that's what happened. And it's those states, along with maybe New Mexico or Arizona, Nevada, places like that, and Michigan, where unemployment is really high, that's drawing values down.
I think that was one of the questions I was going to ask you. What's one of the accelerants, or there's probably a bunch. I'm sorry, you cut out, it looks like.
I'm sorry. There are a lot of places in the Midwest across the country, I don't know if you heard that statement or not, where property values are actually going back up. So lending is not bad in all parts of the country.
That's right. You know, and what you said was, and that's very important, is that there must be some states that are looking at some of these statements in the newspaper and maybe even policy decisions going, man, that doesn't even apply here. But unfortunately, where it does apply is you've got a lot of real estate and a high dollar price like California or Florida, and that's causing a lot of the problems. is...
Well, you're exactly right. The laws that Congress make in the knee-jerk, too far pendulum swinging one way are going to affect always people who did it right, who didn't do it wrong, in areas where they don't need as much scrutiny, but everybody's going to pay for it.
One of the topics right now that's very prevalent is called strategic default. We're kind of shopping for a home right now, and this is something that just happened. There was a borrower that had $1.3 million loan on the home, and they had just been denied a loan modification after going through the trial period, and it was for sale for $595,000. And the reason they were denied the loan modification is because the gentleman in the house made $20,000 a month. So he didn't really have a problem making the payment, I mean, as far as financially, but that was a decision not to do it. Do you see that becoming a pretty prevalent decision in as far as the percentage of foreclosures? Is that one of the reasons that the numbers are accelerating?
I don't know if prevalent is the right word. Is it out there? Absolutely. Some of the big TV networks have done stories on this and talked about it. And if anybody out there is listening right now that's contemplating that, I would appeal to their sense of fair play and tell them that they signed a contract, and to strategically default because values around you are going down doesn't do you or anybody any good. That is in itself fraud, to let your property go back when you can afford to make the payment. People don't want to honor contracts and agreements anymore, and they're walking away from things just because the house across the street went under. It's like a stock. You know, you've taken a risk, but you've got to stay with it long term. We need to look at homes again as places you're going to go to live long term, not piggy banks to get equity lines and pay and do other things with. And it's unfortunate that people are doing that, and I think it's a form of fraud.
In the county that I live in, Riverside County, there's a company called Fitch that does reporting. And I had a hard time getting my arms around the percentage of these defaults. Standard loans, you know, the type that you'd put 20% down on the conventional loan, as we're at 23% default rate on that loan, and we're at 47% default rate on anything that's considered non-prime. That, I mean, I don't even think I've ever heard of anything close to that. And
well, I mean, a lot of that is determined now because unemployment is so high. You know, the real unemployment rate I saw a couple of days ago is actually 17%. It's not 10.
Right.
When you look at the underlying people out there that aren't even looking for a job anymore, and when you've got that amount of people out there unemployed and the economy is as bad a shape as it is right now, you know, there's nothing positive out there happening. There's no hope being given. We're not doing anything to create jobs in this country. So you're going to continue to have higher foreclosures and delinquencies until we get the unemployment situation fixed.
Do you see the rules that are coming, will they in some way be positive? We've got about a minute left. Will there be any positive changes coming to the industry, or you think it's just going to make it very difficult to operate for a while?
Well, let me give you this. Yesterday, the House approved, which was an MBA-supported FHA reform act, to reform FHA. And it actually lowered some of the FHA premiums. You know, Dave Stevens, the FHA commissioner, who has been doing a fabulous job along with Sean Donovan there at HUD. HUD can't reform itself unless it has the money to do it. And finally, Congress has allocated the money so they can upgrade their technology and hire the right people, because you know they are up to 40 in some areas, over 50% of the market share out there right now.
That's right.
So we got FHA reform yesterday. Some of the premiums on FHA are going to be there. And I want to remind veterans out there that they can still get a loan at a very good interest rate with no money down. And by the way, VA loans at 100% down perform better than almost any loan out there in the marketplace. So 100% loans are not bad loans as long as they're underwritten prudently.
Well, David, thank you. That's that makes sense to me that a VA would honor a commitment. And so, David, thanks so much for joining us again. David Kittle, Senior Director in Industry Relations of IMARC. And, David, look forward to having you on our panel pretty soon.
Just call me anytime. It was great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, David, thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.